The presence of gill slits on the fetus, furthermore, is taken by some to be evidence of our aquatic prehistory.
I wonder why they don't just let you stay amphibious.
Ruprecht ponders as they rejoin the throng of the corridor after class.
So that it's up to the individual to choose where he wants to live, on the land or in the water.
Regarding the whole mermaids issue, being amphibious would certainly make it easier to have sex with them.
Mermaids don't have beavers, you clown. Even if you were amphibious, you couldn't have sex with them.
What's the point of mermaids if you can't have sex with them?
Well, I suppose the key thing to remember is that mermaids are imaginary.
Ruprecht notes.
Although, interestingly, some marine biologists speculate that the legend may have arisen from large aquatic mammals of the Sirenian class, like dugongs and manatees, which have fish-like bodies but human-like breasts and nurse their pups on the water's surface.
Von Blowjob, find a dictionary and look up interesting.
What I don't understand,
Jeff says,
is why did the first fish, like the one who started land animals, suddenly decide one day to just leave the sea? Like, to leave everything he knew? To go flopping around on a land where no one had even evolved yet for him to talk to?
He shakes his head.
He was a brave fish, definitely. And we owe him a lot. For starting life on land and everything. But I think he must have been very depressed.
Skippy doesn't contribute to this. That second pill is beginning to seem like a really bad idea. He's getting a weird feeling, a sort of sleepiness. But not nice sleepiness, like earlier. This time it's pricklier, hotter, with a taste in his mouth. Then he remembers he's got religion next, and he feels even worse. Religion class is chaotic, at the best of times. But Brother Jonas's is like a circus where the animals have taken over. The brother is from Africa, and has never quite caught on to how things work here. On Dennis's nervous breakdown leaderboard, he's usually near the top, along with Ms. Twanky, Bizorg, and Father Lawton, the music teacher. Taking his seat, Skippy notices that Morgan Bellamy, who usually sits at the next desk, is out today. Why does this feel like a bad sign?
Who does the world belong to?
Brother Jonas is asking. He has a voice that is soft and dark and rough, like the pads on a dog's paw, and his sentences go up and down tropically, like music, difficult to understand and easy to make fun of.
To whom has God promised the world?
No answer. The hum of conversation continues as before. But the instant the brother turns to drag the chalk, shrieking across the blackboard, everyone jumps out from behind their desks and starts hopping about and flailing their arms. This is a new routine, a kind of a rain dance, performed in absolute silence. At the end of which, when Brother Jonas begins to turn round again, you jump into somebody else's desk, so that he's confronted with 30 serene and attentive faces, patiently awaiting his words, but all in different places from before. The chalk scrapes and squeaks. Around Skippy, bodies whirl and jig. Skippy, however, stays where he is. Suddenly, he is certain jumping around would not be a good plan. Even watching the others makes his stomach lurch. Now the brother has finished writing, and everybody's scrambling into their seats.
Juster!
Lionel Bollard, 140 pounds of creatine and ski tan, is trying to shove him out of his chair.
Juster, move!
Doggedly, Skippy hangs on. Brother Jonas faces the class again. He begins to speak, then pauses, aware that something is amiss, but not sure what. Lionel has ducked into a desk behind and to the right. Skippy can feel his eyes crawling over him.
The meek shall inherit the earth,
Brother Jonas pronounces, pointing to the words written on a gradually sloping incline on the blackboard, a caravan of letters going down a hill.
We may believe that the world belongs to the merchants who can purchase it with their wealth, or to the politicians and the judges who decide men's fates. But Jesus tells us that in the end...
Daniel.
Lionel starts to sing, ever so softly.
Daniel.
Skippy ignores him. Ignoring is what you are supposed to do with bullies, so they get bored and leave you alone. But the problem in school is they don't get bored, because whatever else there is to do is more boring still. The chalk squeals over the board again, and boys leap up and cavort like they're possessed. Skippy's head spins like a top. Lights are flashing on and off in the corners of his vision. Now Lionel's right beside him.
Daniel,
he whispers, so low it can barely be heard, like it might just be happening in his imagination.
Daniel.
His eyelids are so heavy, but he knows that if he closes them, he'll get those whirling pits that make you feel even worse.
So we must ask ourselves, what is it to be meek? Jesus tells us that whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also, the meek man. Yes, Dennis?
Yes. I was wondering, roughly how big would a soul be, roughly? I'm thinking bigger than a contact lens, but smaller than a golf ball, would that be about right?
The soul does not have a weight or a size. It is a bodiless manifestation of the eternal world and a most precious gift from the Almighty Father. Now, everyone, please open your books to page 37. Am I meek in my own life?
Daniel, I've got a present for you, Daniel.
Lionel starts hacking up phlegm from the depths of his throat and gurgling it in his mouth.
Am I meek in my own life? Do I listen to my teachers, my parents, and my spiritual advisors? Am I a... Dennis, is your question about how to be more meek?
Would it be fair to say that Jesus was a zombie? I mean, he came back from the dead, right? So technically, couldn't you say he was a zombie? I mean, wouldn't that be the correct term? Technically?
Sweat breaks in waves over Skippy's zombie flesh. It doesn't seem to make any difference how often he wipes it away. Every noise in that classroom is amplified. Jason Rycroft's syncopated pencil tattoo. Neville Nelligan's snuffling nose. The escalating, be like hum, arising from Martin Anderson, Trevor Hickey, and unidentified others. The hideous gurgling of Lionel. And above it all, inside your head, the terrible carcinogenic skrik, skrik, skrik. The first thing that strikes a visitor to the Seabrook staff room is the predominance of beige. Beige armchairs, beige curtains, beige walls. Where it's not beige, it's buff, or fawn, or tan, or manila. Isn't beige the Greeks or someone's colour of death? Howard is fairly certain it is, or if it isn't, it ought to be. 3 years have passed since he could accurately describe himself as a visitor to the staff room, but the surreality of being here, amidst these figures of terror or hilarity from his youth, these imagos, these caricatures, now ambling around him, saying good morning, making tea, acting as if they were normal people, still descends on him from time to time. For a long while, he found himself expecting them to give him homework, and being surprised, unpleasantly, when instead they would tell him about their lives. But every day it feels more ordinary, which he finds more unpleasant still. Before he started teaching, He never would have guessed how much the staff room resembled the rest of the school. The same cliquishness applies in here as it does among the boys. The same territoriality. That divan belongs to Miss Davy, Miss Nereen and the witch-faced German instructor. That table to Mr. O'Dolig and his Gale Gore cronies. The high chairs by the window are reserved for Miss Birchall and Miss McSorley, the blue-stocking spinsters, currently slumming it over a women's magazine. God help you if you use someone else's mug, or mistakenly take a yogurt from the fridge that isn't yours. A good portion of the staff are old boys. Policy is to hire alumni whenever possible, even at the expense of more talented teachers, in order to protect the ethos of the school, whatever that may be. It seems to Howard like a raw deal for the students, but it's the only reason he got the job, so he doesn't complain. For some teachers, Seabrook is the only world they have known. The female staff can only partially offset the atmosphere of clubbiness, if not downright infantilism, that this creates. As for that female staff, a stringent policy is in effect here too. The Paraclete Fathers view women and womankind with a certain amount of unease, while recognizing their great contribution to society and the furtherance of the species generally. The Order would be quite happy for the fairer sex to continue to do so elsewhere. The presence of a girls' school right next door has long been lamented by the Order as a particularly cruel twist of fate. Of course, the profession being mostly composed of women, some incidents of female teachers at Seabrook is inevitable. It is only by a painstaking filtering process that Father Furlong, the school principal, has mitigated the inherent dangers of this tendency. Assembling a staff that even a 14-year-old boy would have difficulty construing as sexual entities. Most are comfortably into their 50s, and it is debatable whether they were setting hearts alight even in their heyday, if they had a heyday. The dearth of eye candy in the staff room doesn't do much to brighten the atmosphere, which on a rainy morning, after a fight with your significant other, can seem singularly lethargic, or even, why not, deathly. Ambitious teachers go on to deanships. Each year has its own dean, and each dean his own office. The denizens of the staff room are the career mid-rankers, doing the same thing for 20 years, happy to run out the clock. How dismal and old they seem, even the ones who are not old. How hidebound, how cut off from the world.
Good morning, Howard.
Farley chimes, crashing through the door.
Morning.
Howard looks up grudgingly from his essays.
Good morning, Farley.
Chirrup Mrs. Birchall and McSorley from their perch by the window.
Good morning, ladies.
Farley returns.
Oh, ask him.
Miss McSorley prompts her companion.
Ask me what?
We're doing a questionnaire.
Miss Birchall informs him.
Are you a kidult?
Am I a what?
She tilts back her head and peers down through her glasses at the magazine.
The 21st century is the age of the kidult. Adults who shun responsibility and instead spend their lives in the pursuit of expensive thrills.
I'm flattered you should ask me. No, really.
Question one.
Miss Birchall reads.
Are you single? If in a relationship, do you have children? You're not in a relationship, are you, Farley?
He's never in a relationship.
Miss McSorley contributes.
He only likes one-night stands.
Question two.
Miss Birchall reads over Farley's protests.
Which of the following do you own? Sony PSP, Nintendo Game Boy, iPod, Vespa, or other classic scooter?
I don't own any of those things.
But you'd like to,
Miss McSorley suggests.
Oh, sure, I'd like to. If I had any money, I'd own them.
The problem is that we don't get paid enough to be kidults,
Howard says.
We aspire to be kidults. How's that?
He excuses himself from the rest of the questionnaire on the grounds that he is in urgent need of a cup of coffee after his second year biology class. Since September, Farley's been teaching the 7 characteristics of life, and as they approach the class on reproduction, the boys have become increasingly agitated.
They're concentrating so hard I can practically hear it. Today I accidentally mentioned wombs. It was like letting a drop of blood fall into a tank of piranhas.
You could feed my entire second-year class to a tank of piranhas, and they wouldn't even notice.
Howard says morosely.
They'd snooze right through.
That's history. This is biology. These kids are 14. Biology courses through their veins. Biology and marketing.